Hi, this is The Takeaway for Thursday, September 7th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're glad to have you with us.
Well, I think this is the worst hurricane ever meet up in all my life.
Me and my family of seven, including an infant of 2 months, had to shelter in a closet.
Being in the middle of it, being here, it's the most horrible thing that could happen.
I am homeless.
Those voices you're hearing there are from the tiny Caribbean island of Barbuda, which took the full impact of Hurricane Irma yesterday as it swept westward across the sea. Here's the Honorable Gaston Brown, the Prime Minister of Antigua and Barbuda, talking about the damage.
I would say that about 95% of the properties would have suffered some level of damage. They would have lost at least a part of their roofs. Some have lost whole roofs. Some properties have been totally demolished. It is absolutely heart-wrenching.
Just a brief sketch of some of the devastation in Barbuda. There was at least one death reported there, a child just 2 years old. Barbuda's sister island of Antigua was mostly spared, but other islands like the French territory of St. Martin sustained heavy damage. Irma is one of the strongest Atlantic storms on record, and it appears now headed for Florida and the mainland United States. Of course, this is all happening just days after the flooding of Hurricane Harvey, which is already testing the federal response. Later on this hour, we'll look at how ready FEMA is to deal with potential back-to-back disasters of this size. But first, let's get a look at things on the ground in one U.S. territory that's already encountered Irma. We spoke yesterday with Danica Cotto of the AP, who's in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and is watching the storm unfold. She's back with us now. Danica, what are you seeing?
Currently, the wind has completely died down. There's no rain, but we got hit pretty hard overnight. Not obviously as hard as the rest of the Northeast Caribbean, but there are a lot of trees, tree branches, and electric light posts scattered across several roads.
And what were the peak conditions overnight when the storm hit?
There were gusts on the main island of Puerto Rico up to 100 miles per hour and steady winds from 40 to 80 miles per hour. And then on the nearby island of Culebra, which is just northeast of Puerto Rico, and it's a very popular spot with tourists, there were wind gusts of up to 110 miles per hour.
And it's a little early. I realize it's just sort of next day assessment. Any sense, at least from your own eyes, of the kind of damage to property, to houses?
It seems that most structures withstood Hurricane Irma pretty well. Again, there was no direct hit. Most of the damage seems to be a lot of trees uprooted, flooding, and especially power outages. That's a big concern here. There's more than 1 million people without power, and that represents nearly 70% of customers of the island's public power company.
And when we talked yesterday, Danica Cotto, the governor of Puerto Rico, was pretty publicly concerned that citizens there weren't obeying evacuation orders, or at least that some of them weren't. How did that turn out?
It turned out well. They didn't have to force anybody to leave. The National Guard and police evacuated hundreds, if not thousands, of people. We still don't have a firm number on that. And there were more than 4,200 people and 150 pets that went to the island's 154 shelters.
Now, you talked about some of the power lines that were down, and there were reports yesterday from the utilities in Puerto Rico that power could be down for months. Some were saying 3 to 6 months. It's early, but does that look like the case?
It's too early to say. The island's public power company director has said that it could take anywhere from 4 to 6 months in certain areas. And he also said that other areas could see power restored probably within a week. He said to be patient and that today would be a critical day. So we might have, you know, more information as the day goes.
So, Danica, as we survey some of the damage on other islands around the Caribbean, Antigua and Barbuda, is there a sense in Puerto Rico that citizens there kind of dodged a bullet? I know there's plenty of damage, but other islands seem to have gotten hit really hard.
Definitely. Puerto Rico was very much spared. There's just devastation across the Northeast Caribbean. There's about 60% of people in Barbuda that are homeless. Roads, telecommunications systems have been destroyed, and the prime minister said that it might take months, possibly years, to restore. There were 8 deaths and 23 people injured in the French Caribbean island territory, so St. Martin and St. Barts. And officials, French officials, say that they expect that number to grow. You know, again, they're just going out to assess the damage right now. And there was also one death in Barbuda. It was a 2-year-old child, and an additional death in Anguilla. that has also seen extensive damage.
So it's a historic storm, especially for some of the other islands in the area. And I wonder if people in Puerto Rico, who, as we said yesterday, are used to storms every year, it's a fact of life, have a sense of the magnitude of this one.
I think they got a taste of it, nowhere near like the Northeast Caribbean. The governor originally had said that he didn't feel that there was a sense of urgency in preparing for the storm. And he said in part because people, you know, had never experienced something of this magnitude. And now, you know, we're able to see what a storm of this magnitude can cause.
Denica Cotto in San Juan with the AP assessing the impact of Hurricane Irma on Puerto Rico for us. Thank you, Denica.
Thank you very much.
Mandatory evacuation orders are in place in Florida as Irma approaches, from the Florida Keys in the south all the way to Miami and Fort Lauderdale north of that. State authorities in Florida have suspended tolls on roadways to aid in the evacuation, and now Florida is left waiting largely to see where Irma will hit. Tim Padgett is the America's editor for WLRN Public Radio in Miami. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Tim, Florida officials are, of course, watching the progress and the devastation of Irma in the Caribbean yesterday and overnight. Give us a sense of what we know from that region and what storm watchers and officials are gathering from what they see of the storm there.
Well, what they've seen so far from the eastern fringe of the Caribbean, where Irma first hit on Wednesday, I'm talking about the Leeward Islands, the British and U.S. Virgin Islands, islands like St. Martin, for example, that got especially hammered. They're seeing what this storm is truly capable of. For example, in spots like St. Martin out there, it really ravaged the island, not just with high winds and that kind of destruction, but also flooding. I mean, the most striking pictures on Wednesday were of cars submerged all over the island in floodwaters. For the bigger islands in the Caribbean, one of the fortunate factors here may be that the storm is passing to the north of them. And I'm talking about Puerto Rico, the island of Hispaniola, where the Dominican Republic and Haiti are, and Cuba. If it keeps that path across the basin, staying to the north of those islands, it could limit the devastating destruction it does through the Caribbean. The problem then is that it then runs into the southern Bahamas, and that's again where we'll be seeing it hit land and causing more devastation.
So Tim Padgett, you're there in South Florida, and I want to talk about evacuations and preparedness there. I mentioned there are evacuation orders from the Keys all the way up to Fort Lauderdale. It's a huge swath of your region. What do evacuations look like right now? What's going on the ground?
Well, in the early parts of this whole process, they're getting people with special needs, obviously, evacuated to shelters, particularly people who can't do the kind of hurricane prep that we associate with the run-up to a massive storm like this. You know, getting your shutters up, getting your water and food supplies packed away. And Wednesday night, Mayor Jimenez here in Miami-Dade County issued his first mandatory evacuation orders for what we call the zones along the South Florida coast here. Zone A, for example, are the barrier islands, the coastal areas such as Miami Beach. Those are mandatory but still voluntary evacuation orders for those areas. And I think people are taking those seriously because they realize that this storm is stronger than anything that's hit Florida in modern history.
Well, what do things look like on the big north-south highway arteries in Florida, I-75, I-95?
Well, right now, the most clogged arteries are the roads coming up from the Keys. That's where people, I think, are most concerned. That's where we thought the storm might land first. But now, as we're looking at the models, and it's looking as it's going to take this northward right-hand turn up the Florida coast on the weekend, it's looking like Miami actually, unfortunately, could be the first to get clipped. And of course, when I say clipped in regards to a massive storm like this, you're talking a devastating hit. And then it could, we're talking about a storm that then after it clips Miami could ravage the entire Atlantic coast of Florida. And then even after that, head into Georgia and South Carolina.
Tim Padgett, talk a little bit about Miami and Miami Beach, the geography there, but also the subterranean structure of the city. There have been reports that massive flooding or a big storm of this size could really utterly devastate Miami because of the way it's built?
Well, we're already, because of global warming, we've already been dealing in the past decade with a record number of what's called king tide episodes, where even slight rainstorms can cause inordinate flooding in places like Miami Beach. And so the big concern, obviously, and why they're ordering these coastal evacuations, the big concern because of this is storm surge. It could be very significant, and after what we saw in past hurricanes with bad storm surge episodes like Katrina in New Orleans and Mississippi, for example, officials here don't want to take the risk of seeing people caught in that kind of storm surge, particularly since we've seen Miami and Miami Beach have become so vulnerable to it.
Now, of course, Miami Beach is famous for high rises. It's famous for a lot of luxury hotels and condos. But Tim Padgett, at WLRN there, you all have been doing a lot of reporting with Miami residents who live in places that aren't 100 feet above a flood. Let's listen to some sound provided by your station of some Miami residents who might not have such an easy time evacuating.
I went to the store and, you know, got me a couple loaf of bread and brought me some batteries from a flashlight. And that was all I can afford right now.
Let's think about this, right? You already don't have a car. So you finally go to the store, which is not up to par in your community, and they don't have any more things. The reality of the fact of being able to go to another store, which would probably be miles away, is almost unrealistic.
Tim Padgett, those are a couple of Miami residents that talked to your reporters at WLRN about the realities of evacuation and preparedness for them. What are you finding?
Right. That's reporting from our WLRN reporter, Nadege Green, here. And one of Nadege's keen insights in this report is that Miami increasingly is a high rent, low wage metropolis. And when disasters like this approach us, there are increasingly large swaths of the population that can't afford to do the kind of prep you need to do before a weather event like this. So you do have a large cohort here in Miami that really can't hunker down, as they would say, because they just don't have the means to do so. I think, you know, the local and state governments will do what they can to try to get transportation into those neighborhoods. But again, it's going to be very difficult.
Tim Padgett, we're going to let you go, but I want to ask you about the federal response here. We're going to be talking about FEMA and its response in multiple disasters at the end of the hour. Is FEMA on the ground in Miami and in South Florida now?
Well, we're seeing it arrive, and obviously it's tough for that agency because they've been so preoccupied already with the flooding in Houston and Texas. And so we are seeing that state agency get on the ground, but I think people here understand that it may not be as timely as we would have liked because they're already dealing with something across the Gulf.
Tim Padgett, America's editor for WLRN Public Radio in Miami. Tim, thank you.
Thank you.
While most of the country's been watching coverage of hurricanes and DACA recipients with good reason, potentially the biggest story in Washington is still churning in the background. There are new developments in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into possible links between the Trump team and the Russian government. Here with the latest is Betsy Woodruff. She's political reporter for The Daily Beast. Hi, Betsy.
Hey there, Todd.
Let's start outside the Mueller investigation just for a second, because there are investigations on Capitol Hill as well. And Donald Trump Jr., the president's son, appears in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee today. What do they want to know?
One of the main things they're likely to ask him is what he said to Rob Goldstone after that fateful June 2016 meeting with Natalia Veselnitskaya, who is the Russian attorney who has links to the Kremlin. Rob Goldstone is this very colorful character, a music promoter who connected Don Jr. to Veselnitskaya and said that at that meeting, Veselnitskaya could potentially give him information that the Russians had that would help Trump beat Hillary. However, Don Jr. has said that he didn't get any dirt on Hillary in that meeting. So the question is, when he talked to Rob after the meeting happened, what did he say? And what were the expectations going in? And did Goldstone make any follow-up promises after that meeting was finished? It's likely the congressional investigators will ask Don Jr., did he and Goldstone have any phone conversations about Russia's alleged efforts to help Trump defeat Hillary Clinton? Did Goldstone make Don Jr. any promises? Did Don Jr. have any understanding of a broader Russian effort to sort of put their thumb on the scale, particularly when it comes to social media questions, to fake news questions, to Facebook questions? Those are all things that Don Jr. may know about. And of course, important context here is that lying to Congress is against the law, even if it's behind closed doors, even if there aren't any C-SPAN cameras on. So for Don Jr., he's taking a pretty significant risk by going in and talking to Congress today.
Now, you mentioned questions that investigators will have around Facebook activities and buying ads. And let's get back to the Mueller investigation, the criminal investigation that's going on outside of Capitol Hill, because there were reports this week, Betsy Woodruff, that Facebook has reported to Robert Mueller that indeed a Russian company, some people are calling it a troll farm, spent $100,000 on ads during the campaign on Facebook.
Right. And that's something that clearly is going to be a central concern to Mueller, because there are certain theories of the investigation are that one thing Mueller could be looking at are Russian efforts to sort of spread fake news or material that could be considered propaganda. And the important thing to remember about the Mueller probe is that it basically has two silos. In one part, it's a criminal investigation. They're trying to figure out if any Americans broke the law in their interactions with Russians in the lead up to the 2016 election. But the investigation has a whole other part that we don't hear about as much, and that's the counterintelligence investigation. A successful counterintelligence investigation isn't necessarily going to result in criminal charges or legal proceedings. What it would result in, though, if it succeeds, is proof that there was some sort of espionage effort in the United States or targeted at the United States on behalf of a foreign government or a foreign entity.
So two silos, counterintelligence, but then also potentially criminal. There are a couple of grand juries that have been operating. And then we also heard news over the last week or two that Mueller has teamed up with the attorney general in the state of New York, Eric Schneiderman, and they're co-investigating some aspects of this. What's the significance there?
That's important because Schneiderman can only investigate for New York state crimes, while Mueller is only focused on federal crimes. And the president's pardon powers don't extend to state crimes. So if Schneiderman finds that Trump or one of his associates violated a New York law, the president can't give any of those associates a get-out-of-court-free pass. So that means that there's sort of double leverage for this investigation since Schneiderman has gotten on board. He is insulated from Trump in a way that Mueller is not. What's also important, of course, is that Trump can't fire Schneiderman. Schneiderman doesn't work for the federal government. He doesn't work for the executive branch the way Bob Mueller does. So he has some independence here that's extremely valuable.
Robert Mueller has turned to some criminal investigators at the tax agency to help with his investigation. What does that mean?
Right. The IRS has a really small elite investigative unit. It's called Criminal Investigations. This is a group of fewer than 3,000 prosecutors, and the only thing they do are crimes that have a tax nexus. So especially money laundering and tax evasion. The fact that Mueller is working with investigators from the IRS's Criminal Investigation Unit is a strong indicator that he may have found evidence that someone in the president's circle committed a tax crime, particularly tax evasion and money laundering are two things that we know the Mueller probe has on its radar. This is something that's especially likely to be a concern for Paul Manafort. There have been reports that Manafort may have kept money in foreign bank accounts. If Manafort didn't reveal to the IRS that he had that money in foreign bank accounts, that would be a crime, it would be a felony, and it could result in him doing prison time. And if Mueller is able to demonstrate that Manafort had money overseas, that he didn't check the box on his tax form saying he had it, then all of a sudden, Mueller will have significant leverage over Manafort. That's the kind of thing that might bring Manafort to the table and make him more cooperative as Mueller is trying to get information on other folks who are in Trump's broader circle.
you know, Betsy Woodruff, there are so many developments both in the counterintelligence investigation and a potential criminal investigation. And somebody like Robert Mueller always says politics has nothing to do with it. But we know how important politics can be in the end to investigations like this. And over the last couple of weeks, a lot of people have noticed that allies of the White House have set about the task of trying to publicly discredit James Comey, the former FBI director. Why have they been doing that?
James Comey is sort of at the heart of the president's biggest legal problem. One thing we know the president's attorneys are concerned about is the possibility that he could be charged with obstructing justice by firing James Comey. If the president's allies are able to publicly discredit Comey to suggest that he's not a reliable narrator, that he doesn't have a good grasp of the facts of the meeting that he had with Trump, where Trump told him to lay off General Mike Flynn, then that's something that, at least from a PR perspective, could be useful to the White House. Of course, it's only useful if it works. Comey was one of the most controversial figures of the last few years. He's drawn a lot of bipartisan criticism, perhaps more than any other figure in American public life right now. But that doesn't mean, of course, that he isn't someone who's trustworthy. And the fact that so many White House officials are trying to undermine him indicates they're really concerned about what he might have to say.
Counterintelligence, possible criminal activity, and lots of politics all behind the scenes in Robert Mueller's ongoing investigation of possible ties between Trump world and the Russian government. Betsy Woodruff with The Daily Beast, thanks so much.
Sure thing.
Oh! That's it. Venus Williams to the U.S. Open semifinals.
And we may have just entered the Sloan Age.
Madison Keys goes to the U.S. Open semis.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and you're hearing sounds there, of course, from center court and the other courts at the U.S. Open tennis tournament in Queens, New York, now down to its final four. And this year on the women's side, you'll only find Americans among the contenders. Number nine, Venus Williams, is facing off against Sloane Stephens, who you just heard there in the sound in the Sloane Age. And the number 20 seed, Coco Vandeweghe, will play Madison Keys, who's ranked 15th at the tournament. Joining me for a breakdown of this All-American semifinal is Lindsay Gibbs, sports reporter at Think Progress. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, and let's take these semifinals match by match just for a minute here. Talk about Sloane Stephens versus the veteran Venus Williams.
Well, obviously, Venus gets all of the experience points here. She's been in so many Grand Slam semifinals throughout her year, though not at the U.S. Open in about 15 years. But we're going to see Sloane Stephens. It's going to be a real battle of defense versus offense. Both players can play both, but Venus has this powerful forehand, really aggressive game, and she likes the short points, whereas Sloane Stephens is a really great defender.
I mean, having been in so many semifinals and finals at the U.S. Open and in Grand Slams has to be advantage Williams.
Absolutely. I think also Sloane Stephens is just coming back from injury. She never expected to be here so soon. She just started winning matches a few weeks before the U.S. Open after taking 10 months off of the tour due to a foot injury. So I think that you're going to really see Venus is the one who expected to be here. Venus is the one who has made two other Grand Slam finals this year, and she's obviously the veteran.
And then on the other side of the ladder, Coco Vandeweghe versus Madison Keys. What are we looking for there?
Power, power, power. These two players, they're very good friends. They know each other very well. They played some great matches this summer in the U.S. Open series leading up to the U.S. Open. And both players have huge forehands and just go for their shots. I think you're going to see a lot of line painting. And you might see some errors as some nerves get in as they're playing for a spot for both of them, their first Grand Slam final.
Now, Lindsay Gibbs, we've talked a little bit in the past about American dominance, especially in women's tennis. But this is utter dominance. This is four Americans in the semifinals with room for nobody else. What's going on here?
Well, you know what? It's just really exciting to see all these players hitting their stride at the same time. With the younger players, Sloane and Madison and Coco, they've all had potential. They've all made Grand Slam semifinals at different points. But this summer, I think you saw all of their talents really coming out and them all peaking at the right time. They're all three healthy. They're all three experienced. At this point, they have all been to a Grand Slam semifinal before. So it's just really neat to see these players come into their own on the biggest stage in front of their home crowd.
Does this say that women's professional tennis is the American game right now, or am I taking it too far?
You know what? I think that right this second, absolutely, but it's still an incredibly global game, and that's the strength of the sport. You know, you have personalities coming from all over the world. You have talent. I mean, the top five, the top 10 is still filled with international stars, and this isn't going to be another era where I think slam after slam you're going to have four Americans in the semifinals like it was with Capriati and Davenport and the Williams sisters. However, this is a great sign for the future, and there's reason to be optimistic about the future for all of these women.
The semifinal on the women's side, four Americans facing off against one another, and I can predict it will be an all-American final and an American champion on the women's side. Lindsay Gibbs, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Lindsay Gibbs, sports reporter at Think Progress. The U.S. Conference on AIDS begins today in Washington, D.C., and while we've come a long way since the 1980s in treating the disease, access to testing, to quality care, and to information can vary drastically depending on where you live in America. One recent report found that in Louisiana, rural patients with AIDS were 60% more likely to die of their disease than patients in the city. Now, those numbers come from a nonprofit organization called HEROES that works to improve the lives of those living with HIV in the rural South. Linda Meredith is the director of research and development at HEROES, and she says most risk factors for HIV and AIDS are compounded in rural areas.
People are much poorer. They have less education. They are three times as likely to be incarcerated as in the bigger cities. So in that way, the setup, if you will, for AIDS and HIV in the rural areas is more likely. But the other thing is that what's been trying to be done in rural areas is just to drop the same solutions that have been helpful and have demonstrated progress in the larger cities. And the rural areas are different. Some of those folks who live there have to drive at least 640 miles to get an HIV test. And so unless you are very compelled to know your status, you're not going to take that trip. Also, there's only one place to get treatment and care in rural Louisiana, and that place requires that you come four times before you get antiretroviral therapy, which is nowhere near the standard of care that's seen outside of rural Louisiana.
What would be a viable solution, in your view, to that disparity? Would it be mobile testing and mobile care that can really cover those miles that are so difficult for people to cover themselves?
That's one idea. If you look, for example, only at geography, but then overlay poverty and the lack of public transportation or the lack of ability to get your own self there, mobile testing and mobile care might be a good place to start.
And what else beyond that?
We think that we need to make a better connection between testing centers where people first learn that they have HIV and the care center where they need to go immediately to begin the process of taking care of themselves and the virus. There is no such connection right now. People are informed of their HIV test results, and then it's up to them to try to find the place of care, to try to schedule the first appointment. To try to figure all this out is devastating. So if there were more connection, if the treatment centers were able to find a way to put people on to treatment the very first time someone walks through the door, those are the kinds of things that we think would begin to affect the devastating numbers in rural Louisiana.
Linda Meredith, what about prevention? Is it a different situation to talk about safe sex practices in rural areas in Louisiana than it is in New Orleans or Baton Rouge?
There is only abstinence education able to be provided in the public school system. So if you're at risk for HIV, first of all, how would you even know that if someone hadn't taught you? And then also you would have to go completely out of your way to get information about how to protect yourself.
You know, Linda Meredith, what you're describing is striking to me in so many ways. I mean, when you walk down the street in the middle of a big city in this country, you might see bus advertisements, billboards, very much out in the open. And it sounds like in the places that you've studied in rural Louisiana, in many ways, it's the exact opposite.
I think that well describes the picture that we see in rural Louisiana. I'll give you a quick example. when we were preparing for disseminating findings from this report to the media, we asked several people who are clients of Heroes if they would be willing to talk to the media about some of the problems they face. And with very rare exceptions, no one was willing to be public about their status.
What does that say to you?
It says that there's a lot of stigma, that people don't feel good about themselves, that a society has told them that they aren't worth it anyway, and they need to keep quiet about this. And those kinds of things have been the direct cause of mortality, less healthcare seeking from individuals. It's a very bad situation.
Linda Meredith, Director of Research and Development at Heroes, dedicated to improving the lives of people with HIV in the rural South. Linda Meredith, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We just heard about some of the disparities in the rural South when it comes to HIV treatment and prevention. But where you live in America can have an impact in other ways as well. There are laws all over the country that makes it a crime for an HIV-positive person to fail to disclose their status, not only before sex, but before a medical procedure, before going to the dentist, even if they're in a fight and they spit on someone. And some advocates now say the new reality of HIV and AIDS makes those laws obsolete. Two recent studies are shedding new light on HIV and AIDS transmission and helping to fuel this debate. In the studio with me now is Catherine Hansen. She's founder of the Center for HIV Law and Policy. Catherine, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Let's get a survey, if we can, of some of these state laws that I just mentioned around the country. What do they say now?
Well, there is a broad patchwork of laws. There are 34 states, two U.S. territories, and even the federal government that have some kind of HIV-specific criminal law. And what they criminalize varies from some states that only focus on sexual intercourse to some that focus on any kind of contact with a bodily fluid.
And this, but what we're talking about disclosure, so that the commonality here is if you're HIV positive and you know it, to varying degrees, it can be a crime to not disclose that either to a sex partner or a doctor, a dentist, somebody who might come in contact with bodily fluids.
Well, there are very few states that actually criminalize failing to disclose to a dentist. But you're absolutely right, Todd, that the focus is on disclosure, although the laws by and large are called criminal transmission of HIV. In fact, the liability hinges on your ability to prove that you told someone you had HIV before you engaged in whatever this conduct is that is prohibited, something that is, you know, as a practical matter, pretty difficult to prove.
And how strict are the penalties that we're talking about here?
The overwhelming majority of states have felony penalties. So it can be anywhere from several years to right now we're working with a young former college student in Missouri who received two consecutive 30-year sentences, supposedly because he did not discloses HIV to partners.
And just to be clear, failure to disclose, to get a felony, does it have to be malicious? Does it have to be somebody specifically not disclosing in order to harm another person, or can it be simply negligent?
That's a great question, and that's the other irony, I suppose, of the way these statutes are actually named. In fact, the thing that's unique about these laws in terms of the criminal law is that they do not require any kind of evil intent or intent to harm, which is very, very unusual. The criminal law was created to deter intentional bad conduct. And so the common denominators for all of these laws are several things. One, there is no requirement that you prove an intent to do harm. And then the other two really hinge on wildly inaccurate perceptions about HIV, that it's highly infectious and that it's deadly when you get it.
Well, let's talk about some of those perceptions and what some of the new data are saying, because at the dawn of the era of AIDS in the 1980s, this was a legitimate epidemic when there was no cure, when people didn't understand transmission well, and when for many people, once they contracted HIV, it was a death sentence. attitudes have changed and some of the data have changed. So how is that informing what we know about these laws?
Well, it's surprising how little attitudes have changed. And for one thing, and I think this is really important, these laws have never been justified. We have known since the 1980s that HIV is not transmitted by spitting and biting. There were many, many studies of households where individual members fought, bit, shared toothbrushes, no transmission. We've known for a very long time that those things don't transmit. And yet we have, you know, a couple of days ago, a prosecutor in Billings, Montana, pressing criminal charges against someone who may have had mental health issues for biting a corrections officer because, as he put it, it's a known fact that biting is a source of HIV transmission, even though in the history of the world, there has never been a documented case of transmission to a corrections or law enforcement person.
Meanwhile, in several other areas where we know the transmission is a risk, for instance, with sexual activity, especially unprotected sexual activity, some things have changed significantly since the old years. Treatment. Antiretroviral therapy has extended the lives drastically of people with HIV. But how has it affected transmission rates and how people are thinking about the likelihood of transmission now?
Yeah, another great question. I think it's what has happened with the development of effective treatment has profoundly changed what it's like to live with HIV, and it has affected transmission. But again, I think it's really important for listeners to understand that when we talk about a dramatic risk reduction in transmission through sexual contact, and I'm not talking about oral sex. I'm talking about anal sex and vaginal sex. The risk, even without treatment, was in a single sexual contact, less than 2%. So we're talking about a dramatic reduction in the transmission risk of a virus that is not easily transmitted.
So it was low to begin with, and now with more available treatment, what are the transmission risks now for people with reduced viral loads because of medication?
As close to zero as you can get. I mean, nothing is zero. It's not a zero risk that you will fall in the shower and die tomorrow.
Right.
But that doesn't stop you from taking showers.
Okay, but still at the same time, those medications have drastically reduced viral load and the chances of transmission. But not everybody's on medication. We just heard how many, many people in rural areas never get access. And that would suggest that transmission's still a risk if medication isn't available and that maybe disclosure in some places might still be a good idea.
Disclosure is not a condom. It's not latex. And there are many other sexually transmitted infections, some that are far more easily transmitted. And HPV is a great example, of a virus that is extremely common. Pretty much anybody who's sexually active gets it at some point and is the cause of pretty much all vaginal, penile, even many throat cancers that will kill you far more quickly than HIV.
So there are moves afoot in some states to repeal some of these disclosure laws.
Quite a few states. California is one of them, Ohio, Tennessee, quite a few. We're working with advocates in a number of states across the country.
HIV and AIDS medication has changed the face of that disease and is making transmission in many places far less likely. And many advocates say disclosure laws need to go by the wayside. Catherine Hansen is founder of the Center for HIV Law and Policy. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Todd.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick, and we want to end the show today with more discussion on Hurricane Irma, but also natural disasters more broadly as Americans experience their brunt along their coastlines. With the floodwaters from Hurricane Harvey still lingering in parts of Texas and Louisiana, Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands and soon likely Florida are now dealing with the onslaught of Irma. And all of this has left the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, stretched to its limits, and Congress is rushing to send money to that agency before it runs out. On Wednesday, the House passed a quick $7.4 billion spending bill with the hope of much more to come, and there will be much more to come and much more needed later. Joining me now is Elizabeth Zimmerman. She's former Associate Administrator for FEMA's Office of Response and Recovery. Elizabeth, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Todd.
Give us a sense, if you would, of the magnitude of FEMA's job now. With Harvey in Texas, Irma approaching and hitting hard, already having hit a couple of territories of the U.S. And I'm sure these aren't the only places where the agency is in business just because the TV cameras are around.
That is correct, Todd. So yes, so FEMA's resources are definitely stretched at this point, as you mentioned, from Hurricane Harvey in Texas and Louisiana, the thousands of people that are down there responding to that event, as well as those that are preparing and being stationed in Florida, also in the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. So not only that, but you have the fires in the West, and you have other events that are going on, but obviously the main resources for FEMA are being sent to the response efforts from both Harvey and from Irma.
And what would it be like inside the agency right now with multiple crises simultaneously, and then sort of some of the more chronic problems in the fire ravaged West that you talked about? Is it a chaotic, rushed attitude? Resources stretched thin, people not sleeping. What would it be like?
So I can tell you that everyone's adrenaline is going at full speed. FEMA operates out of the National Response Coordination Center there in Washington, D.C., so they're able to adjudicate all of their resources, as well as the whole federal family and the voluntary agencies, faith-based, to be able to coordinate everything from the offices in that coordination center in Washington, D.C., to make sure that the resources are getting out to still in Texas and Louisiana, but then also the forward into Florida. So they have the one location there. There are 10 FEMA region offices across the country that are also participating in this event, and they have the lead with those states that they oversee and they support.
So there's preparedness, that's job one, and then we've watched as it switches to search and rescue during the floods in Houston and the surrounding area. Does all of the search and rescue now have to move quickly from Texas to Florida? How does that work?
So it's very key in any type of emergency that you get in with your search and rescue if they're needed. You get them in, you get the people rescued, you get them to a safe shelter, and then you get those search and rescue folks back to their home locations or to a place to rest, because you never know when that next event is going to happen. With Irma, we've had days to prepare for it, which is good, but a lot of times you can have a no-notice event, such as an earthquake somewhere, and you got to be prepared for somebody to be able to go in and to be able to perform those duties. So it's key to get the search and rescue folks in, get their mission accomplished, and then get them back for rest, because you never know when the next event will happen.
So we talk about preparedness here, Elizabeth Zimmerman. It's a bit of a throwaway term, because I think sometimes it hides what it really means to be prepared for disasters on this scale. Can you give a sense from where you sat within FEMA working on response and recovery about what preparedness and response really means in a crisis like Harvey, and then with another one a week later, the size of what we think Irma could be?
Yes. So, I mean, preparedness from the federal standpoint, that's something that we are constantly doing when I was there. They still are looking at the catastrophic planning so that you're working with those state and local governments that the federal government is in support of, as well as the tribal nations, to be able to get them prepared, to get them to understand what their threats are. They know best what types of events could impact them, and then what they need to do to be prepared for that, as well as the citizens and how they can be prepared, how they need to be prepared. Just like right now in Florida, they need to be prepared to leave when they're told asked to evacuate, and to be able to get out and to have those critical things that they need to have with them when they do leave their homes.
FEMA participates in search and rescue, of course, and in emergency response, but thousands of people in the Houston area were going through FEMA to find out about financial aid if their homes were destroyed and they didn't have flood insurance, which was a lot of people and probably more to come. FEMA has an administrative role behind the scenes there that can be critical.
Yes, they do. So the first line of anybody's recovery and to be able to recover their homes and their personal property is insurance. And like you say, very few people in Texas had flood insurance. This was a huge event and impacted many more if people didn't believe they lived in a floodplain, but floods can happen anywhere. So FEMA is that backup to after your insurance if whatever's not covered. And then FEMA does, through their individual assistance program, is able to provide assistance. But it's key to note that it's only $33,300 is the maximum anybody can receive from FEMA if they have lost everything. The average payout is around between $5,000 and $7,000 for an individual, a household. So it's key to know that FEMA is not going to make anyone whole.
Elizabeth Zimmerman, can you talk a little bit about the culture within FEMA, especially since Katrina? That agency was scrutinized and criticized, as we all know. After Hurricane Katrina, Americans remember the president telling Brownie he did a heck of a job. He was head of FEMA. He didn't do a heck of a job. Has that led to a cultural change within the agency? Was there a radical shift after that and the shock of what went wrong in Katrina?
Well, I wasn't there at that time. I came on in 2009 with FEMA. And you have a lot of great people that are very committed to the mission. And that's where their real passion is to helping disaster survivors and communities following an event such as any one of these, Harvey, Irma, you look at Katrina. It's the individuals that are really there on the ground helping those disaster survivors. And so really these types of events really bring that adrenaline, that passion of the workforce, of FEMA, and of the whole federal family into play and allowing them to do what it is they're there to do.
Did you ever hear any of your longer-term colleagues, you didn't get there till 2009, but what did people say to you about before Katrina and after Katrina within the agency?
So, I mean, like I say, it goes to how people are treated and how people are able to do their job and to really be able to help the disaster survivors. And that's where people's hearts go to. That's why many people have been with FEMA for 10, 15, 20, 30 years. And they stay there. They stay there because they are committed to the mission and to helping others.
Well, I mentioned at the top that Congress is working on a quick $7.2 billion. That money looks like it's needed right away. How much more do you think?
It is needed right away. If FEMA is under $1 billion to respond, they can burn through easily $200 million in a day. They need this money to be able to respond, and they need it quickly. We have no idea, based on what Irma does, how long that money will last. Congress needs to be prepared to put more money in there if this money burns through quickly, and just in the response efforts.
FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, responding to two crises on the coasts of America, not to mention fires burning in the American West. Elizabeth Zimmerman, former Associate Administrator for FEMA's Office of Response and Recovery. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, as we cover Harvey and Irma and their impact on the American coastline, we've been asking you, have you or someone you know ever received assistance from FEMA?
My name is Vanessa Walker. I'm calling from St. Simons Island, Georgia, where we're about to evacuate for Hurricane Irma. But I did receive some FEMA funds back in 1977. My family and I were affected by a flood in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. We lost a lot, both personal items and business inventory during that flood. And later in the year, my family and I traveled to Washington, D.C. on a convoy of school buses to go advocate for emergency assistance funds. There were a few staff members and some legislators in the offices, and we went in door to door and told them about our experiences and how hard it was.
Surviving a disaster and then advocating in Washington, D.C., one experience in an American family with FEMA. Have you or your family had any experiences with FEMA? We want to know. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thank you so much for listening on this Thursday. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the state devoted to entrepreneurship and innovation. Learn more about the benefits of growing a startup or scale-up business in Arkansas at arkansasedc.com.